Okay, let's take advantage of the exercise to contest, if you like. Let's do 25 minutes of silent meditation. as we tried following that meditation in silence, I'll just, those were the instructions earlier, but Mipham had some kind of additional bits, so I'll add an additional bit just to think about it. He says, and this is where he's sort of commenting on it and saying, well, obviously, you begin to see how we're continually under the influence of discursive thought, even when we're resting. And he says, this is his words, there's no end to discursive thoughts. They won't disappear in and of themselves. For all their multiplicity and number, they bring no real results or benefits. They can't put an end to negative mental states or suffering. Should you wish to be free of suffering, you must get rid of its respective causes. To this end, you must recognize the faults of discursive thought and emotion. Since time immemorial, you've been under the control of these thoughts, and as a result, have not acquired any genuine qualities. Now, give up attachment to such thoughts and do all that you can to cultivate stillness of mind. If you can do this, you will gain many qualities, such as clear or uncontaminated concentration, clairvoyance. You will gain the power to abide by the natural state and find supreme bliss. With such an understanding of the faults and benefits, and having gained a degree of control over the mind, continue to practice with unflagging diligence until you can achieve calm abiding. Where you have passed through the meditative experiences of movement, achievement, familiarity, stability, and ultimate experience, and achieved the samadhi of the pinnacle of samsara, through familiarity with this method of meditation, the moving energy wind of activity which gives rise to many thoughts will converge at your heart and enter the central channel. Wild, hard-headed thoughts will be gradually pacified, and your mind will become increasingly workable and positive. The activity wind movement of the subtle energy wind within the body will naturally come to dissolve into the central channel. The effect of this is that the rider of said energy, discursive thought, will be without its mount and will naturally dissolve into empty awareness, and you will be without thought. Discursive thought will be calmed, and you will abide in the open luminosity of their absence. So, going back to where we were, and we were getting into philosophical and metaphysical discussion, which is good, and I'd be the last person to discourage it, because it's kind of, I like it myself. But I think it's worth thinking that metaphysical discussion sort of is unending, in the sense that there's no verifiable or falsifiable conclusion, but it's very interesting to do. Nagarjuna, and I would not want to close it down, Nagarjuna, a very famous Buddhist philosopher, when he was talking about giving up attachment, and he was a philosopher himself, he was saying, but we also have to give up attachment to views. If suddenly we think that the view, you know, is inherently existing from its own side, independent, absolutely true, maybe it's time to think, oh, maybe not hold on so tight. But the dialectic can be very, very interesting. I think Nagarjuna actually said, you know, views or taking a view and engaging in the dialectic is like a medicine. Yeah? But if a medicine to free us or liberate us from attachment, But if we become attached to the view, the medicine becomes poison. So, again, it's taking a very thoroughgoing, relativistic and pragmatic approach to the dialectic.
There's also an attachment to knowing as well, isn't there? Like, we won't always know, we'll never know the answers to everything, and that's fine to accept.
Yeah, that's okay too. Yeah, I think that's true.
Maybe there needs to be more acceptance.
Yeah, but then there could be, and philosophers do argue, some will say, well, there'll never be an end state. There'll never be a situation where any consciousness could know all and everything and draw a line under it. And another philosopher might say, well, why not? In a similar way, this is the nature of philosophical problems, say from a Buddhist, or not just a Buddhist, but probably anywhere east of the Near East, it's not at all kind of unusual or questioned that if you say, well, there was no beginning and there is no end, that's fine.
Yeah.
But we're sort of raised on Plato and Aristotle.
Exactly.
And first causes, and God created the world. So we think that's a bit strange. There must have been a beginning. But no, there mustn't have been. There doesn't have to have been. So what I'm saying, there's the metaphysical argument.
Mm.
You can argue about that, interestingly, and, you know, the dialectic can be really informative to both sides, but it never comes to a conclusion kind of thing. So in that moment, people can get very, very attached to views, and going back to His Holiness's original motivation, they do so, and they do to the extent that they will conduct war with one another and kill one another almost solely on the basis of a different view. So attachment to views turns the medicine of liberation into poison. It's kind of always worth sort of thinking about that. And there was, even when we're thinking about profound things, you know, things that mean a lot to us and all of that, another perspective on this is everybody or anybody familiar with an Italian author called Italo Calvino? Yeah? Mm-hmm. Yeah, he's a marvellous author, well worth having a look. But when the millennium was turning, they were interviewing authors and saying, what do you think are the qualities that we need to help us get through the next millennium? Yeah? And it was reading lots of really erudite answers from many, many famous authors, and all really, really good. I couldn't fault any of it, but the light bulb and everything went on for me when I saw Calvino's answer. It was only one word: lightness. Lightness. Anyway,
lightness
of touch.
Mm.
Yeah, the incredible lightness of being like a feather, not to get heavy. Again, that lightness is an approach that's possible if you're not tightening up around something. If you're not, it gets heavier and gets more dense and gets more concrete and gets more solid, and the view gets more limited if we get like this around it. We feel it happening physically, emotionally, mentally. Anyway, that's what was a great answer. Calvino, good. Got another example, because it kind of segues from what we were thinking about colours and perceptions, and I hope that was kind of a sufficient example, you know. And remembering in mind, that's sort of considering only one aspect of one sense. The same thing is going on with hearing, the same thing is going on with smell, the same thing is going on with taste, and the same thing is going on with sensation. Of the colour thing, the audio analogy is really there. There's no independent, inherent existing sound. Bird does this with the voice box, there are sound waves. Well, we call them sound waves, but they're not really sound waves, they're vibrations. Yeah? They do whatever they do if they're within range of a receiving apparatus, which is a rather crude, bony thing with a bit of skin stretched over it. But that's somehow connected to the nervous system, which goes into one of those mechanisms in the brain, which is dependent on a consciousness, and the consciousness dependent on the brain, and it interprets it and hears that as a sound. So the sound, much like the colours, for its existence, depends upon, it arises on the source, the receptor and the interpreter. Without all those causes and conditions being in place, there is no sound. Huh? There's nothing to grab. There's nothing out there. There's nothing independent from its own side, sound. There's another sound one of the one we're going to do next, which we'll try. But anyway, I hope that kind of was a sufficient example with an aspect of only one sense to think about how we might see analogies in other senses. To do that, we've got to be present to our experience. We may find many of our own kind of thing. And I hope it's kind of sufficient just to challenge the notion that things exist as they appear, inherently, independently, out there from their own side, like that. Now, this kind of segues into another one. Have we all got a bit of paper, yeah? Is anybody without paper? So I can get you a bit of paper by using this. Have you got a pen?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, good. I'll get a bit of paper. Want a bit about A4 size, not because of its size, but because of its distance. If you've only got A5, then what we'll do long ways. If you've got A4, then do it this way. Yeah, I'll show you what you've
got.
Oh, good.
I'll need a paper.
Yeah.
Oh, you like the paper? Thank you.
Oh,
good, thank you. Does anyone have a spare pen?
You won't need a pen all the time, so it'd be quite quick to do, so you can just share with somebody who hasn't got a pen. That's fine. But what we need to do on it is over about that length in the middle, I'll mark. See if I can do it this way. I'll do it first, so it's easier to show you. Make this one on the right hand side a star and this one a dot.
On the right side or on the left?
No. So on your left, star, on your right, a dot, yeah? Like that. Around that size, can be a little smaller, nothing. Has to be overly precise, just roughly.
Left.
Everybody got that
star.
One? Huh?
Left is a star.
Yeah, your left is a star, your right is a dot, a circle. Has everybody got one?
Mm-hmm.
Huh? Yes. Then you hold it out in front, yeah, at eye level, close the right eye, and with your left eye, look at the circle, not the star. But at the moment, I hope, even though you're closing your right eye and looking with your left eye at the circle, you can still see both, yeah? Slowly bring it back on the same plane towards you, and there'll come a point where the star disappears if you keep your eye focused. on the circle, and all you've got is white paper. Mm. And you might have to move it just slightly sideways, but you think, oh, the star disappears at some point. Can you see it?
It reappears.
Yeah, it disappears and reappears. Yeah, so you move it about, play with that. But isn't it funny how if you keep your eye focused on the circle, the star disappears and it looks like blank paper. Well, the real illusion with that is one yet to be seen, because it appears that the star disappears and there's white paper. It's because we've, with the rods and cones in the eyes of a certain shape, there are blind spots. So when the star disappears, what's happening is there's nothing there. It's blind. Yeah. But you don't see a hole in the paper. You see white paper because there's a mechanism in the brain that fills in the gap. Right? It fills in the gap and it looks. You say, well, it's nothing wrong with the paper. It's just the star that disappears. But there's actually holes in our vision that through experience we correct and say, oh, there's something, there's a mechanism in there that says, oh, it's like this. And maybe if we go back to our evolutionary biologists, there's another one which I can't reproduce, but you can probably find it by looking it up. And if I'm trying to put together little video clips, and if I can find one of this, it's nice. But this is one that's like a, it's an S shape, and it's made up of black lines. And there's a gap in the middle of the black lines, because yeah, they're made up like that. And that, so there's like a blue S, yeah? Well, the blue S actually isn't there. And how do you know that? Because if you put a light meter over the paper on which it's done, there are no photons other than the white paper coming off. But we see a blue one. In fact, if you just cover two of those blue lines up, then it appears as it is with white lines. So there you're actually seeing something that ain't there at all. Except and insofar as the brain is producing an illusion of the blueness. And the evolutionary biologist would say, but when you're going back away and there's a snake that's highly dangerous and you can only see a part of it, we've learnt to join up the dots and say there's a snake there. But so habitual has that become that it produces these sorts of illusions, which they're hardly harmful, because in order to do this, we've had to do this, close one eye and then fiddle about. But it kind of demonstrates to you what we take for granted ain't as it appears. Yeah. And that's the same with the rest of our sensory organs. If we hear, you can get musicians to do separated notes of certain kinds, and we'll make up a continuity. We all enjoy film, don't we? We now know, yes, of course, now it's gone digital. But how was it originally done? By taking individual frames. You know, you remember as a kid doing that with a pack of paper and drawing matchstick men? And if you've got the patience to draw a lot of them, you go like that and they move and it makes you laugh. You know? That's the basis of cinematography pre-digital. Yeah? So a lot of single frames create the illusion of movement. What happens when we watch cars going at a certain speed? The wheels appear to be going the other way. Anyway, there's lots of them. Lots and lots and lots. So yet again, yet they appear like that, but the way they appear is not the way they actually exist. So, I mean, going back to the evolutionary one, there was another one that I picked up that I thought was really, really good, and it's really the business of the different number of photoreceptors to sense light of different wavelengths. Well, of course, we all know that there are other forms of life that are able to see things that we can't see. So bumblebees can actually see the ultraviolet part of the spectrum. So they've got three photoreceptors absorbing ultraviolet, blue and green regions of the spectrum. Yeah. So the ability to detect the ultraviolet light gives an explanation to biologists of why some flowers have patterns visible only to that part of the spectrum. It's because they want the pollinating bees to come and sort them out, and they know they've evolved knowing that these insects that are required can see in that spectrum. Yeah? And there's also a number of animals that can detect infrared. Yeah? So a snake, for example, can see things because it's looking for small, warm-blooded prey. So it sees them not with its eyes, but with infrared receptors, which are called the pit organs, located between the eyes and the nostrils. So snakes can colour objects according to surface temperature. And we borrow from that technology when we use infrared imaging to do the same thing. So it's quite fascinating. So where I wanted to go with this is there's a segue into when we come into the realm of our, what you might call our social experience, our mental experience, our relationships with other people, what we do. You know, this is coming more to, okay, well, we can see all this, but how does it have more bearing on who we really are and our sense of identity and all of that? How do we get closer back to that? And I'll give you an idea about how it segues. This is a rather good book by a guy called Rob Berbier, who's a resident teacher down at Gaia House, called Seeing That Frees, Meditations on Emptiness and Dependent Arising. And you'll see where the segue is. You know, I could sum it, but I think it's better you have it in his words. This is called seeing the holes in things. Like, it's an analogy of the hole in the paper, which is covered over with the white. When the mind believes in and builds up certain concepts and their significance for the self, it gives them a solidity they do not possess on their own. Then we can very easily feel burdened and imprisoned in certain situations that involve these concepts. For example, the roles we have in life are concepts, agreements, again, between human beings. And yet, so often, we can over-identify with them or let them define us. We're even more likely to fail to see their lack of solidity. One obvious area this occurs is at work. For some years now, I've been the resident teacher at Gaia House. Being so visible to so many people so much of the time in a role like that, it would feel quite claustrophobic and burdensome if I were to perceive myself all the time as the resident teacher. Until I'm asked to by someone or by a situation, however, I don't have to step into that role. And although I could, I need not conceive of myself as the resident teacher, as I am simply walking down the corridor, or reading a book, or sitting on the toilet. Even if I tried, I would probably forget at times. If I pay attention, I see that there are countless such holes, moments and stretches in any day when I am not and do not have to be the resident teacher. And I can also see that this role is actually only one of the various roles I have in my life at present. I am at times a friend to friends who have nothing to do with Gaia House or even the Dharma. At other times, I'm a musician, a poet, a writer, a citizen, a neighbour, a brother, a son, an uncle, a room cleaner, an activist, a cook. So easily, one role gets overemphasised in an unwise way, and we contract around it in identification. It becomes charged for us then, and it may begin to feel like a painful weight. Opening out to the seeing to recognise the wider context can open out the contraction so that vitality, interest and creativity can flow more freely and more widely. The psychology involved here is not often simple, but in addition to acknowledging the life in other roles, this seeing of the holes in any role can be immensely helpful in exposing its lack of solidity. By seeing these gaps, we burst a bubble we've believed in and felt constricted by, and reveal a spaciousness in which we can then move more freely. We find that it's very possible to be fully committed to the responsibilities a role entails and to feel profoundly the sense of meaningfulness it may have for us without solidifying or over-identifying with that role. And he'll go on a little bit if you bear with me. This one's very good because it applies to where we are. This way of looking can be extended into many areas. A retreat is another example, where it can be easy to solidify a perception of something and then struggle with it. Focusing too much on the perceived differences between being on retreat and everyday life, we might feel either imprisoned in the form, the structure, the schedule and the way of being on a retreat, or become attached to that form and then have trouble letting go and leaving it at the end. Usually we do not realise, however, that the perceptions of certain differences are being fabricated and inflated by the mind and its tendencies of attention. We may lose sight of the fact that the elements and activities that comprise life on retreat, walking around, sitting around, eating, sleeping, washing, meditating and talking, for instance, are actually quite similar to those of life off retreat. Admittedly, retreat life involves a bit more of some things, like meditation, a bit less of others, like talking. And it may also include a bit more of certain kinds of sensations, like knee pain, and a bit less of some other kinds of sensation. Essentially, though, moments at least of such experiences, meditation, silence, talking, bodily pain, even knee pain, may be encountered anywhere. The differences between situations are not as stark as we might first suppose. Investigating more closely, I recognise that my world, wherever I am, wherever I move to, is a world of inner and outer experiences, that is to say, appearances, sights, sounds, smells, tastes, bodily sensations, emotions, thoughts, memories, dreams and intentions. Some of these fragments, the more elemental appearances, are pleasant, some not so pleasant, and some neither particularly pleasant nor particularly unpleasant. Viewing through the lens of deconstruction, that's going back to that basic phenomenological approach, viewing through the lens of such deconstruction frees up my sense of things, and I can begin to question whether it really is as different as it seems to be from place to place. Is any environment as solid as it seems? When I look in this way, it's hard to find the retreat, the workplace, the vacation, the travelling to, or any situation I might find myself clinging or clinging to or struggling with. We could also apply this way of looking to meditation. At some point, it's almost inevitable for a practitioner to unwittingly reify the concept of meditation and then to measure themselves and to suffer in relation to that solidified concept. Looking more carefully, I can recognise that meditation does not have the kind of solidity that the mind might be giving it. If I'm sitting in formal meditation session and actually spacing out for a few moments, is that then meditating or not meditating? And conversely, if I'm walking down the street in the city and spontaneously, without any effort on my part, strong mindfulness arises just for a few moments, is that meditating or not? What makes it meditation? We fail to notice the holes in things where they admit what to seem to be their opposites. When we do, though, we see that they're not so solid and that the contrast between things are not so black and white. Then our vision opens and relaxes, and some ease can enter into our relationships with these things. So, anyway, I hope that's kind of explained why I thought it was better to deep dive a bit. Otherwise, these things just remain intellectual concepts. Or we say, what's all this stuff about perception got to do? Because, of course, it applies not only through the five sense organs, but also mental consciousness and, you know, the one we're really looking at, most importantly, our sense of identity, which we normally perceive as something solid, inherently existing, unchanging, always there, I'm this, I'm that, I'm behind my eyes. It's all very solid and concrete. That's where we're going, but I hope that's a nice way in. Anyway, there's only 5 minutes to... It is absolutely wonderful, right? It's a great contribution because it's right where we are. You know, there's an old... It may be older, but probably the oldest version I know is in India, you know, of the people going across the desert on the camel, and they find this sort of naked fakir standing in the middle of the desert, and they get off to offer him some water. And he sort of takes the water like this, drinks the water and does this. And then someone, come and sit down and have something to eat. And he said, well, I can't get out. And they said, what's the matter? And then he describes that he's in a cage. And they're saying, well, we can't see the cage. It's exactly what we're doing when we over-solidify roles, or we say, I'm like this, or I'm not that sort of person. We actually build an invisible prison and live in it, you know. There is one which is, it's an old one, it's funny, and it's not to be taken too literally, and you don't want to sort of upset professionals or anything like that. It's just to be taken at its level with a little of Calvino's lightness. The old one said, neurotics build castles in the air, psychotics live in them, and psychiatrists collect the rent. But, of course, for the poor person that's there, for poor us, because we're now thinking, oh, it's other people. But, of course, we're doing this all the time. We all tighten around our own roles, our own ideas about ourselves, and so on and so forth, in a way that to somebody outside of us would think, that's crazy. So how do I get in? So how do you break down the reification? How do you deconstruct it? You look for the holes. It's really, really good. In the same way that you can deconstruct your assumptions about the continuity of perception by identifying the holes. It's a great way in. Yes, now I know where you are. When I went to art college, another one which was a way of this using the same way, this you were using it with children and their reification of their own perception of themselves, conditioned and all the rest of it. That when I first, I was out for about just over a year, and then I went to art college. And my objective drawing tutor was absolutely, you know, a wonderful guy. And I know what he was trying to do. He was thinking of how can I break down all the stuff they've learned about how to draw and get them to see it in a different way. and then maybe stop drawing like the teacher that taught them to draw drew, and do their own stuff. And of course, what he did was he got all the chairs and all these sorts of things, piled them up in the centre of the studio. He said, "Now I'd like you to," because we all had big easels, things like this, "I'd like to draw this." He said, "But I don't want you to draw the chairs and the tables. I want you to draw the spaces between them." Of course, you ended up with a similar looking accurate drawing, but it had been created by not thinking about that, but by looking at the spaces. In doing that, you can't do it in the conditioned way. You have to make different sorts of marks. So a different sort of style emerges. And it, again, going through the holes opens up the possibility of seeing what's actually there in terms of the person's creativity, ability, and so on and so forth. Yes, it's very, very interesting. Anyway, I hope it's been food for thought. And we'll come back, but it's kind of gong any time for lunch. Thanks very much.